I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. Summer in Canada, so delicious and so short. Do we really want to spend our free time indoors binge-watching Succession for the third time?
Yeah.
Or crafting perfect shots of our picnic for a social media post?
You guys, this looks so cute. Just move the grapes a little. Okay, perfect.
Or rage-scrolling and arguing with people we don't even know?
The reason ChatGPT will never be Roy Batty is that he has aspirations.
This week, a summertime challenge to reset our relationship with technology. We talked to a privacy law prof and an addiction psychiatrist about the consequences of tech overuse and how to tackle it. So given that lots of us overuse at least some of our digital tech, why don't we just cut back? Meet the experts who are going to help us out.
My name is Anna Lemke. I'm a psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. I'm not on social media because I know I wouldn't be able to handle it. My addiction to romance novels really kicked off once I got a Kindle. And that happened to me while I was treating patients with addiction and thought actually that I was immune to the problem of addiction since traditional drugs don't have much impact on me. Turns out I just hadn't yet met my drug of choice.
Hi, I'm Gaia Bernstein. I'm a law professor at Seton Hall Law School. I'm the co-director of the Institute for Privacy Protection and the co-director for the Gibbons Institute for Law Science and Technology. And I'm the author of the book Unwired, Gaining Control Over Addictive Technologies. Even though I am so aware, I find it very, very hard to do better. And maybe that's why I wrote the book, because I feel the problem all the time. So when I need to work, I just take my cell phone and I put it on 20 minutes timers and I close all my windows and I work and then I open everything and check my emails and do this again. But I still find myself, you know, waking up in the morning, checking the weather, meaning to check the weather, and then I'm still in bed and I've just, for half an hour, been looking at all my emails and social networks accounts.
We're going to hear more from Gaia later in the show. Right now, though, Anna has spent years treating people for addiction and mental disorders. Her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence, is about how our pursuit of pleasure actually makes us more miserable.
And how we should embrace a new form of asceticism in order to navigate this dopamine-overloaded world.
We've heard a lot about dopamine in relation to things we enjoy, like chocolate or getting Instagram notifications. But what is it and how does it actually work?
So dopamine is a chemical that we make in our brain. It's essential for survival. It's involved in pleasure, reward, and motivation, but also movement. Dopamine is released in our reward pathway in our brain in a way that the more we release it and the faster that we release it, the more potentially reinforcing is that substance or behavior. One of the most exciting findings in neuroscience in the past 75 years is that pleasure and pain are co-located in the brain. So the same parts of the brain that process pleasure also process pain, and they work like opposite sides of a balance. But there are certain rules governing this balance, and the first and most important rule is that the balance wants to remain level. It doesn't want to be tilted for very long, either to the side of pleasure or pain. And our brains will work very hard to restore a level balance after any deviation from homeostasis. And the way that we do that is first by tilting an equal and opposite amount to whatever the initial stimulus was. So I eat a piece of chocolate, that releases a little bit of dopamine in my brain's reward pathway. My balance tilts to the side of pleasure, but no sooner has that happened than my brain adapts by downregulating dopamine transmission, not just to baseline, but below baseline. I imagine that as these neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again, but they like it on the balance, so they stay on until it's tilted an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. That's the come down, the hangover, the blue Monday, that moment of wanting one more piece of chocolate or watching one more TikTok video. So with every pleasure, we pay a price. And that is how we restore a level balance. The reason that's important is because with repeated exposure to the same or similar stimulus, that initial deviation to pleasure on the balance gets weaker and shorter, but that after effect gets stronger and longer. In other words, those gremlins start to multiply, and pretty soon we end up with enough gremlins to fill this whole room, and now we're in addicted brain. Now we need to use, not to get high, but just to feel normal. When we're not using, we're in a chronic dopamine deficit state, walking around with a balance with a bunch of gremlins on that pain side, experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, depression, and craving.
Anna says we've all become susceptible to compulsive digital overconsumption thanks to our smartphones. But what does digital technology or smartphone compulsion look like? And how does it differ from addiction, if it does?
There's actually, from a phenomenological point of view, not that much difference between addiction to a screen or a device or the digital media that comes with it and addiction to a drug. People usually start out using for one of two reasons, either for fun or to solve a problem. That problem can range anywhere from boredom, isolation, to depression, insomnia, inattention, and everything in between. If the drug works for them, and I'm using that term drug very broadly to include our digital devices and the content that we get from them, then people will repeat that behavior because it's reinforcing, it feels good, it solves a problem. And as I said, with repeated exposure to the same or similar reinforcing stimulus, our brain adapts such that we start to downregulate dopamine transmission in response to that stimulus, not just to baseline, but below baseline, that chronic dopamine deficit state. And now we're caught on that hedonic treadmill, that dopamine vortex, where we now feel as if we're using autonomously and through our own choice, but actually the drug itself is commanding us to use because that physiologic drive to restore homeostasis is so incredibly overwhelming for all living organisms. And in a world in which we have almost infinite access to highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors, it's very easy then to reach for that drug again in an attempt to restore dopamine homeostasis. But really what we're doing is chasing our tails.
And so is there something like a continuum between, you know, overuse, use disorder, addiction, and are those categories sort of generally recognized within the psychiatric community when it comes to behaviors like use of our digital technologies?
Well, first of all, addiction broadly is recognized as a spectrum disorder. You can be a little bit, moderately, and a lot addicted. And we don't have any blood tests or brain scans to diagnose addiction. We base this on phenomenology or patterns of behavior. We have a list of 11 criteria. The more criteria you meet, the more addicted you are on that spectrum of mild, moderate to severe. The question of whether or not digital addiction or device addiction or tech addiction is recognized, I will say to you, it's increasingly recognized. And I think general consensus is on the part of most healthcare providers today is that yes, people can get addicted to technology and to digital media and the devices that deliver them. But it's not yet included in our Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is our compendium for diagnosing and getting reimbursed for treating, I might add, certain mental illnesses.
So how would you explain the urge that many of us get to sort of pick up our phones during these short-term idle times?
When I think about what makes the world such an addictogenic place today, four things come to mind. Potency of the stimuli, meaning the more they release dopamine and the faster the dopamine is released, the more reinforcing and potentially addictive it is. Access to the stimuli, one of the biggest risk factors for addiction, is just simple access. If you can get your drug easily, you're more likely to try it and more likely to get addicted to it. And of course, as we've talked about, digital drugs are everywhere. And we can, you know, we can access them running for the bus, so to speak.
Yeah.
Number three, you've got quantity. So quantity and frequency matters, right? When you think about that pleasure-pain balance, if you leave enough time in between use for those neuroadaptation gremlins to hop off and for homeostasis to be restored, you're never going to get into addicted brain, right? You're going to have time to reset yourself. But we don't do that because the quantity is infinite, right? If we had as much cocaine as we have YouTube videos, that would be a whole lot of cocaine, right? A lot more of us would be struggling with cocaine addiction, but we're struggling with, you know, video and YouTube and TikTok and that kind of thing. And then finally, the third category is novelty. So something new. Dopamine loves newness, which is why we can literally get addicted to the news. Because although it's like not happy information, it's new. And the brain and dopamine loves that newness, and we can start chasing that instead.
Yeah. In Dopamine Nation, you share the story of one patient of yours named Sophie, who came in seeking help for depression and anxiety. And I should say that all of your patients in the book have given their permission for their stories to be shared. And among the things you talked about was how she spends most of her waking hours plugged into some kind of device. Could you tell me a little bit about her story and what that shows us?
Super common scenario. She came in looking for help with depression and anxiety, kind of reporting a constant low-grade depression, anxiety with some peak panic attacks, and wanted, you know, a pill or some kind of psychotherapy. But by the way, she'd already tried a lot of medicines. None of them had worked very well. She'd done some psychotherapy. It hadn't really helped. So I postulated to her, as I do for many of my patients, you know, I wonder if it's just plain old dopamine overload, that you are stimulating your brain so much with all of these hits of highly reinforcing stimuli that your brain is just reeling with this fire hose of dopamine trying to compensate, and it's put you in this kind of chronic low-level dopamine deficit state, which is characterized by depression and anxiety. So I wonder if you could try unplugging for some period in your day, because she was literally all of her waking hours from the moment she got up, kind of like, you know, how smokers, like the first thing in the morning, they have to start smoking in because they're in withdrawal.
Right.
And she said, well, that would be really boring. And I said, yeah, it would, you know, and I don't like minimize that.
Yeah.
Like I actually bow down in terror to the experience of boredom because it's terrifying. Because just imagine if you really did let yourself like recognize that you have nothing to do. Wow. Well, what is it all for? You know, scary stuff. So I just kind of validated, it probably will be boring. And also you'll be in withdrawal. Right. So you'll be anxious and more irritable and more depressed for a period of time. I said, but if you can just hang in there and kind of get to quiet, you might discover something about yourself and your own brain, and you might feel better. So she did that, and it was difficult for her to do. But what I loved is she came in and said, you know, I for the first time ever, I'm now walking from my dorm room to my classroom without listening to music or something else online. And she said, I'm starting to notice the trees, which I just thought was great. You know, this sudden ability to like tune into the world around her. Which, of course, is what makes people feel alive, too. A big problem we're seeing, in addition to this compulsive overconsumption of digital media, is we're seeing people who feel really untethered, like they're not real or the world's not real. And that's a really scary mental space, because if you don't feel real, then maybe you're not real, and then it doesn't matter if you die type of thoughts. But when people unplug and reconnect with other people in the real world and the natural world, they start to feel alive again. And so it's super important.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, we're talking about the consequences of tech overuse and how to tackle it. Right now, my guest is Anna Lemke, psychiatrist and the author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Anna's work focuses on addiction treatment, including to our digital devices and social media platforms. In her book, she talks about the false self, an idea developed by psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott. She explains how it's fueled by our compulsive social media use.
So Winnicott's idea of the false self is the constant energy and creativity we're putting into managing our identity and persona and trying to manage the environment around us so that we're perceived in a certain way. And of course, social media, it's that idea on steroids, right? It's the false self on steroids. These curated images, these fake narratives, you know, only showing one side of yourself, the likes, so that people really end up feeling in a way that they only exist in this virtual space, that that's their only identity or that's their entire identity. And otherwise, they have no identity. You know, I have a lot of young people when I suggest that they get off social media, just the suggestion sends them into a florid panic attack because they really don't feel in a way that they exist without their social media persona. And yet at the same time, the virtual persona, It's a fake managed persona. Even if it's authentic, it's performative, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not, there's not that deep connection. There's this sense of constantly curating and managing your false self for an audience. So, you know, disconnecting from that and trying to, you know, feel real in the world means also not continually trying to manage your identity or the way you come off or your narrative or the people around you, but rather just allowing yourself to live in the flow of your experience, which means that you can recapture a kind of a spontaneity and an unknowing and an acceptance of the unknown as life unfolds.
Yeah. Are there ways that contemporary North American life itself kind of pulls us into our phones, you know, in spite of whatever our best intentions might be?
I would say everything about contemporary North American life. I mean, and you know, it's a collective problem. You know, when I say to parents, oh, well, you know, get your kid off their phones and send them out in the back alley to play kick the can. Well, they might do that, but there are no other kids back out there, right? So it's really a collective problem. Even if you and I try to get off of social media, we have now impoverished our in real life experiences because we're investing so much of our creativity in the online world. And the result of that is that our real lived experience actually is more impoverished. It's less interesting. Mm. You know, it's like when I work with families, I say, yeah, you know, make mealtimes a time that people are not going to be on their devices and go on a vacation together when nobody has their devices, and anticipate when you do that, that it will be unpleasant, painful, and boring because you'll be in withdrawal, number one. But number two, nobody has talked to anybody for a long time. We haven't been cultivating our lives together in real life. And so it's going to take renewed investment in our in-life experience and creativity to find things to do together, whether it's, you know, a board game or a card game or some kind of collective experience.
So what are some of the tips that you recommend to patients with real addictions to their phones or digital technology, the internet? What do you recommend for them?
Yeah, so my prescription is threefold. Abstain, maintain, and seek out pain. It sounds really horrible for a psychologist to be prescribing pain, but let me get there. First, I recommend that they have an abstinence trial from their digital media of choice for 4 weeks. We call that the dopamine fast. It's not that they're going to not engage in any kind of reinforcing stimulus, rather that they're going to identify what's problematic for them. Maybe they're going to not play video games or not watch pornography or not go on social media or not go on a particular social media app. And they're going to do that for 4 weeks. Why? Because 4 weeks is the average amount of time it takes to reset healthy dopamine reward pathways, which allow us to be able to actually look back and see true cause and effect because we don't see it when we're chasing dopamine, but also allows us to reset those reward pathways so that we can get pleasure from other types of rewards and reinforcers. I always warn them, and this is really an important part of it, that they're going to feel worse before they feel better. So when we take off the reinforcer off the pleasure side, those gremlins are going to slam us to the side of pain. We're going to be restless, uncomfortable, anxious, and our brain is going to be making up all kinds of reasons why we really should go back onto that website, even though we committed to not doing it. Just recognize that as part of withdrawal. Feel some empathy for people with severe addiction to drugs and alcohol, because that's exactly what happens. It's kind of like this terrible, terrible itch that you're not allowed to scratch. But if you can get through those first 10 to 14 days, that itch starts to subside. The intrusive thoughts of using start to go away. And if you can make it to weeks 3 and 4, people just feel so, so much better. mood is better, less anxious, sleep is better, able to be more present, able to have more time. Yes, more time means also some existential terror in the face of what do I do with my time? But people pick up old hobbies. They get more creative again. They have the ability to have sustained attention. And then after that 4-week fast, we talk about what was good, what was bad, and what comes next, and what the maintenance phase will look like. Now, many, if not most people, want to go back to using that digital medium, but they want to use differently. They want to use less, and they want to use in a healthier way. So we talk very specifically about what that will look like. And often that involves self-binding strategies. So this is literal and metacognitive barriers that we put between ourselves and our drug of choice. Things like actually turning off our phone for periods of time, putting it physically away from us. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to actually physically not have our phones on us for some period. Leave it at home. Leave your house without it. It's good practice to do that. Get that physical distance. And then do the other kind of monitoring, deleting the apps that you don't want to use. You know, people with more severe addictions have to take more extreme measures, right? Like people with sports betting addiction have to ban themselves from sports betting websites. I've had people who have even had to actually put their devices into a bank vault for a period of time. Wow. It depends on the degree of your addiction, but extreme measures are sometimes required. But that's that kind of self-binding. And then the seek out pain part is exactly what it sounds like, that, you know, we know this pleasure-pain balance, that if we press on the pleasure side, the gremlins go on the pain side. But if we intentionally press on the pain side with mild to moderate doses of pain, then the gremlins will hop on the pleasure side and we can get our dopamine indirectly by paying for it up front, which is a healthier way to get at it. And that's things like exercise, intermittent fasting, ice cold water immersion, but not just physical pain, also things that are emotionally or cognitively challenging, meditation, prayer, reading a hard book, doing a creative activity without interrupting ourselves. So those are the things that we recommend to kind of reset a healthy dopamine reward pathway. And it's hard work. You know, it requires constant maintenance, but it really does make people feel a lot better in the world.
Yeah. And just finally, Anna, we started looking at this because we're thinking, how can we have an enjoyable, very short Canadian summer without scrolling on our phones constantly? So beyond what we might sort of clinically call addiction or use disorder, you know, many of us do have that general sense that our time would be better spent doing something else. Could you give us one or two practical tips to make the next couple of months more than just a summer of scroll?
Well, the really practical thing I recommend for folks is to do a 24-hour digital fast. That is, don't look at any screen or touch a screen in any shape or form for 24 hours. And then just observe your own mind and notice the kind of craving, intrusive thoughts, restlessness, anxiety. Just even pay attention to the number of times you think about your phone and want to touch it. Because that alone can be a wake-up call for a lot of people to help them understand how these gremlins work and how addicted we've all become, which I think can then provide the motivation to want to change those behaviors. So whether, you know, maybe you can't do a 4-week digital fast, but maybe you can do a 24-hour digital fast. Maybe you can do that once a week. Or maybe you can commit to intermittent fasting where you don't go on the device before 9 a.m. and you get off before 5 p.m. So there are all kinds of little ways. And, you know, the ways in which to manage this technology is only limited by our own creativity. Doing the dopamine fast with somebody else, whether it's for, you know, one day or a week or 4 weeks, get together with a friend or a family member, do it as a family together, you know, collectively get together for a digital Sabbath. So I just can't emphasize enough. People, like, they want it to be some fancy, magical thing, but really, it's really obvious. It's just hard to do.
Yeah. Anna, thanks so much for your insights on this.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Anna Lemke is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University and author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence.
Well, the title, Medium is the Massage, is intended to draw attention to the fact that a medium is not something neutral. It does something to people. It takes hold of them, it roughs them up, it massages them, it bumps them around. And the general roughing up that any society gets from a medium, especially a new medium, is what is intended to be indicated in that title.
You're listening to Spark from CBC Radio.
Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, and this time on Spark, we're doing a tech wellness check. Whether it's playing too much Fortnite or scrolling through Instagram late into the evening, tech overuse can have real consequences on our ability to be productive, to spend time connecting with the people we love, or even just enjoy a beautiful summer day without distraction. As we heard from Anna Lemke, today's consumer tech can hook us into a troubling dopamine trap that can be hard to break free from. Earlier, we heard from law professor and author Gaia Bernstein. She says the whole problem sort of snuck up on us.
We basically started using our devices gradually, and we didn't really make a decision, I'm going to spend 5 hours on my phone. We just, you know, started emailing on the go, started texting, joined Facebook. So we don't realize the fact that every time we pick up our phone, we think we're just picking up the phone to check the weather. Mm-hmm. And then we end up spending, you know, an hour on the phone. And we don't realize it because the designs that tech companies have made to keep us online for longer are invisible to us.
In her book, Unwired, Gaia argues that the idea that we can individually control how much time we spend on our screens is a sort of illusion.
So even if we've read in the news that tech companies want to addict us, we don't remember it when we're there and we just stay on for longer. And we believe still that somehow we're in control.
Earlier, Anna Lemke mentioned that today's consumer technology is engineered to be addictive, which means we keep coming back for more and more. Gaia explains the thinking behind the design decisions made by tech companies on platforms like TikTok and Instagram.
They've taken really well-known psychological principles and they have made them part of many design features that we see everywhere on the internet. So, for example, they took a very well-known experiment with soup. They gave soup to one group and that group just ate a normal bowl of soup and the other group had a bowl of soup with no bottom. So they ate 70% more, not realizing that they were eating more. So basically, their stopping cues were taken away. And that's what's taking place all over the internet. If you look at the infinite scroll, which we have on Twitter, on Facebook, and Instagram, there's never an end to the page. Mm-hmm. So we keep going and going for much longer than we intended. If you go on TikTok or YouTube, you know, one video follows another. Sure. Netflix, one episode follows another. We don't have stopping cues, so we keep going. There's just one way that they have implemented this.
Yeah, in the book, you also mentioned Snapchat's Snap Streaks as an example of a feature that specifically targets younger users. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I honestly feel that Snap Streaks is the most vile feature of all of them because there is nothing there but a way to get kids back on Snapchat. Basically, a kid has to send another kid a snap streak and they would return it within 24 hours. They started a streak. Now they have these charts, which are like popularity charts, which shows how many streaks they have with each kid, 120, 500, and they get special badges. The thing is, if one of them fails to send a streak that day, everything is gone. The whole streak is gone. And if somebody's parents take their phone away, they have lost everything. And the thing is, you don't have to send any content in this streak or anything intelligent. The whole idea is to get people on Snapchat so they will see the advertising. And so I think you know, with some of the features like likes or comments, you can say, well, there's some sense to it, it's part of the social network, but here it's really there for nothing but to keep people on for longer.
Yeah. So it sounds like what you're saying is that we make getting unplugged or compulsive use of technology an individual's responsibility, but behind the scenes, you know, some of the best minds in engineering and design are essentially creating these platforms and devices that keep us hooked on them.
Right. And they also want to make sure that we think it's our responsibility. And that's a very old trick that corporate industries have used for many years. I've studied the tobacco industry, the food industry. The idea is that once truth comes out that their products are addicting the users, immediately they come out with this defense mechanism. Well, the consumer chose to consume our products, so they're responsible for anything that happens. And that's exactly what the tech industry is doing. Mm-hmm. They're giving us these self-help tools, for example. Like on iPhone, you have something that you can see how much time you spent on your phone, or you can limit how much time you spend on apps if you feel like it. And so the idea is that the user is in control. And if we fail, which we all do, it's our fault. Mm-hmm. And then we keep blaming ourselves.
So when you look at features like screen time reports that Apple sends users, are they at all helpful, or is it just sort of, I guess, for show in a way to give us the illusion of control?
If you look at the studies, people are quite excited at first. They have a name, digital well-being tools.
Yeah.
So the idea was now it will be much better. But the studies show that after the initial excitement, it didn't work for most people. You know, sometimes somebody finds a personal trick that works for them. But in general, they don't work. And the reason they don't work is they don't get to the heart of the matter. They don't, for example, cancel the infinite scroll. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they don't make a limited time the default. They make you as the user have to go and limit yourself. That results in something very, very different.
Yeah. So you say that there's a distinction between addiction and overuse. Can you tell me about that and explain what the difference is there?
Yeah. So the only formal form of addiction is gaming addiction, which was defined by the World Health Organization and is also a category in the DSM. And there's usually kids, and they usually play games to an extent that really impacts their life. They know they start failing school, they are unable to stop. And so that's an addiction. And then lots of studies about other forms of addiction, which are not formally recognized, like smartphone addiction, social networks addictions, or internet addiction. And in some ways, I don't think the distinction matters so much. I think it is a really social phenomenon. The fact that we all overuse so much that many of us have at least some of the symptoms of addiction. For example, when I don't have my phone with me, I feel anxious. Mm. I don't think I'm the only person. When they suddenly realize I left the phone at home, it's very difficult for them to cope. So I think addiction is not necessarily the useful term, even though it's a very popular term. I think it's the overuse. And I think what happened with addiction, it's made people think about individual solution. Mm-hmm. So the first people who wrote books about this, most of the people who wrote books about this are psychologists. And they think about therapy, they think about self-help measures. And I think it's much more of a social issue. Mm-hmm.
I'm Nora Young. Today on Spark, we're talking about tech overuse. As much as our digital technology helps us be productive, entertains us, and connects us, those same technologies can leave us wasting time, joylessly scrolling, and ignoring the people we care about. So today we're doing a little checkup and seeing how we might reset our technology use just in time to get out and enjoy the summer. Right now, my guest is Gaia Bernstein, a law professor and author of Unwired: Gaining Control Over Addictive Technologies. When it comes to tackling broader technology overuse, Gaia wants to shift the responsibility from users to the technology industry and the companies that are creating platforms and devices that keep us hooked. She argues that collective action is necessary, including legal measures.
I would break the measures into two types of measures. There are direct measures to exert pressure on technology companies to redesign the phones, the apps, and there are some bills for that, or some actually laws have passed in the US. So basically to make certain addictive features illegal, or like the infinite scroll and some other things. Or there are lots of bills and laws now in states passing to prohibit kids from going on social networks from a certain age, or to require parents' consent. There are class actions by parents and against social networks and game manufacturers. And I think one of the leading ones is actually in Canada, in Quebec. There's a lawsuit against Fortnite that has really progressed and goes to the heart of the addictive features of Fortnite. And I think it's very interesting to see what will happen in Quebec, because that's where tobacco companies also lost very badly. Yeah.
There's also the case of the Seattle School Board, I think, which is suing several prominent social media companies. And I think the basis of that is the harm to children. What do you make of that case?
I think these are very interesting. And I start with Seattle, and there's so many school districts that have joined in recent weeks. So basically, they're suing for the mental harm to children, but they're also suing for addicting kids, because they know that kids are suffering because they spend so much time on the social networks. And it's very, very reminiscent to what happened with the tobacco companies, because it's hard to believe now, but smokers who sued tobacco companies lost for years, because this idea that you chose to smoke and so you're responsible really worked for the tobacco companies. They kept winning. And one of the things that created the shift was that when attorney generals sued for the costs of paying for people's health expenditures. So this is very similar, because it's not the party who's choosing to play the games. It's not the party that's choosing to smoke. The schools and the attorney generals are bearing the cost. So it helps break down this very strong defense of you chose it, you're responsible.
Yeah. You draw parallels between the fight against the tobacco industry and also the sort of junk food industry and what we're currently facing with the tech industry. So what lessons can be learned there and taken to the tech sector?
So a group of teenagers sued McDonald's in New York because they suffered from obesity and diabetes. And the court agreed with McDonald's that the kids chose to eat McDonald's and therefore they're responsible. And it's interesting to learn not just what didn't work, but what did work. So you can see the vulnerabilities going forward. One place you can see it is when intent to addict is revealed. So another factor that changed things in the litigation against tobacco companies is when finally, after decades, evidence came out that tobacco companies actually knew that nicotine was addictive and they were making sure that their consumers were addicted. We already have this evidence. I mean, Frances Hogan, who worked for Facebook, testified in the U.S. Congress that they knew that Instagram was harming girls the longer they stayed on, and they decided to keep going. Mm-hmm. So we have the evidence. And the other place is kids, because we don't think that kids are making choices. We don't think that kids are responsible. We're very fine with making choices for kids. And, you know, kids cannot buy cigarettes under a certain age. Adults can still buy cigarettes. Kids in the US, the schools are required to weigh them and send the BMI to parents in the fight against obesity. This does not happen to us when we go to work. Our employer is not going to weigh us. So it's important, because I think that will be the way out. We're already seeing that most of the activity is to protect children. The thing is, once you start basically prohibiting features for kids, it's very likely that they will end up being prohibited for all of us. It gets harder and harder to make the distinction.
Right. What about the argument that tech companies gathering our data results in harms? Do you think there's any legal heat to that?
Well, I think there definitely is. I think it's part of the same business model. I mean, why are they gathering our data and taking our time? Because they need our data in order to target accurate advertising at us. And then they need us to stay for as long as possible so they can gather more data, and then for us to see the advertisement. So I think gathering data has lots of, you know, unexpected results. So what makes me optimistic, and my book is intended to be an optimistic book, is Privacy is well ahead of the fight against technology addiction because there are many more laws against privacy. I think that's the second way to really change things is to change this business model. And regulating privacy and basically making it illegal to collect data about children, for example, makes the whole model less lucrative. And if this model finally changes and we go to different models in which we don't get everything for free, which we're used to, like Gmail or Facebook or Instagram, but maybe we pay as we go. Can you imagine if you go on Instagram and you have to pay as you go? You're likely just to think about how much time you're spending, and then the companies will not be so focused on putting design features that are just meant to keep you there for longer, because this is no longer the business model. So I think we have to sort of expand our imagination beyond this business model that's been part of the internet economy for two decades now.
Yeah. Beyond legal action, which can often take years, what are sort of collective efforts that can be taken even at a more local level, like within communities?
I think that the most important place is schools, because basically the policy for schools has been for over a decade now, the more technology, the better. A laptop for every child. And the idea was this will help bridge gaps between populations and the kids will learn better, will be better prepared for the future. But the mega studies have actually shown that in most cases, a live teacher is much more effective than technology. And that even bridging gaps between population has not proven to get better with the use of more technology. But we kept going, and until the pandemic, teachers sort of held back on that because they wanted to keep teaching the way they were used to teach. But with the pandemic, they had no choice, and they got used to using games like Minecraft and Roblox in the classroom or putting their lectures on TikTok. And the thing is, hours in class add up to hours at home. But also, if you're learning on your computer in class, your homework is going to be on your computer. And if Minecraft is legitimized by school, how can a parent tell their kid to get off Minecraft? So I think that we have to assess every technology. Is it better than a teacher or not? Maybe game quizzes are good for math because kids are more motivated, but maybe not because of the dopamine boost that kids get from that. But I think that's something that can be done much quicker in individual schools. And that's where I think we need to start.
What about the role of businesses, for example, in creating these kind of hyper-connected spaces? I'm thinking of how, you know, when we used to travel by plane, that would be at least the one time when you would disconnect. But now more airlines are offering in-flight high-speed Wi-Fi. Is there something to be said for encouraging businesses not to do that?
Yeah, I think definitely that's another place where people and individuals can make a difference. Because you can design for overuse or you can design for less use. Many airports now have four laptops sometimes at every table between the diners. So they can order and they can... So you really, there's no way for you to talk to anybody. Since the pandemic, many restaurants still keep QR codes instead of menus. So if you have a QR code, you have to take out your phone, use your phone stays on the table. Parents bring iPads for their kids, restaurants... The things as a business owner that you can do, you can give crayons to kids when they come in. You can think about how you design your business to encourage people not to use their phones by giving them regular menus. I think there are lots of ways that people can make an impact individually, not just by suing tech companies and writing congressmen.
Yeah. I mean, I think even if we acknowledge that the responsibility ultimately lies with tech companies, are there ways for individuals to strike a better balance to reduce our technology use and address that overuse?
So I think there are several things that people can do. I think with smaller children, you have much more of an impact because you can decide what technology they use and what they don't use. Of course, sometimes it's hard for parents. You're going on a long plane ride. You want the kid to have an iPad. But you can decide what the norms are for your family, and you can decide whether you are allowing them to use devices on the dinner table, and you can decide whether you want them to use devices when they go out, and you can try to, if you can, delay the age in which they start using a smartphone. I think when it gets to kids in middle school or high school, you don't really have that option. And I think that's why I really argue for switching away from fighting at home and fighting in your family to fighting collectively, because you can't isolate your child. You can talk to them if they're willing to listen about how they feel, how they felt during the pandemic when they were stuck at home, and when they were sitting in front of the computer all day, how it makes them feel. And you can try doing small things for yourself, like some people delete an app they feel that they're addicted to. But I think these are all things we need to do sort of to bridge the gap. I do believe there's a lot of legal action and things are going to change. But in the meantime, we have a generation of kids who sat for more than a decade in front of screens.
Yeah.
And they're becoming adults. So I think we need to do everything we can to sort of try to change norms in little ways until things change more socially.
Yeah. Gaia, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gaia Bernstein is the author of Unwired: Gaining Control Over Addictive Technologies and a law professor at Seton Hall University in New Jersey. Over the course of this episode, we've heard our guests explore the problem of tech overuse and also what some of the solutions are at a societal and at a personal level. Regular listeners will know we sometimes like to give out homework on the show. In a few minutes, I'm going to issue a challenge to you that will no doubt be challenging, so much so that the Spark team has agreed to be part of it, starting with me. In addition to way too many nights looking at cute cat reels when I should be going to sleep, I have this habit when I'm working and I'm a little stuck or I don't know what to work on next, I just reflexively flip over to social media and scroll. And I do this even though it doesn't really bring me any joy. And even though I know that being outdoors is something I really do enjoy and really do need for my mental health. So why don't I walk away from the computer and get some fresh air? That's my own challenge, to swap in a walk around the block for scrolling. But what about Spark senior producer Michelle Parisi?
I look at the phone right before I fall asleep at night. I should be going to sleep, and then I lose an hour or two just looking at the phone.
Yeah. So what are you looking at?
I've noticed recently that I do this pattern, actually, where I open a series of apps, the same ones in the same order, because I'm quote-unquote checking them. So the pattern is I go, Facebook, do I have any notifications? And then I immediately leave Facebook because I never even go there except for to see if I have notifications.
Right.
Then I go Instagram. I check my notifications. I may lose some time scrolling through pictures and reels of unusual animal pairings. And then I close that. And then I do my personal email, look at my work email, and then I go into this word game app. And it's one of those games that you just level up forever.
And what were you doing before you started doing that stuff on your phone? Like,
oh, you know, reading paper books, where I used to do most of my writing. So it seems like I was definitely more into introspection and activating different parts of my brain rather than like shutting them off by just mindlessly scrolling or continually leveling up, winning fake coins.
Right. Right. So what are you going to commit to doing then?
My commitment is to try and make sure that the last half hour and hopefully the last hour before I fall asleep every day is not spent on my phone.
Okay.
So even if it just means I lie there and possibly I'll fall asleep. Remember when we used to just go to bed and fall asleep? That's my goal this summer, is to go to bed and fall asleep without looking at my phone.
Okay. I'm proud of you, Michelle.
Thanks.
Next up is Spark producer Samrui Johannes.
I feel like I'm not as bad as I used to be. And that's because I've run out of space on my phone. And that's because of my overuse. I think I probably have like 5,000 photos on my phone. And I have a hard time letting go of those photos. Like even transferring them onto my computer is a struggle for me. Like I feel like I hoard things, including things on my phone. But when I did have space on my phone, I felt like I was one of those aspirational downloaders. Mm-hmm. So I'd go on the app store and I'd be like, I feel like I would really benefit from this like wellness app.
Yeah.
Or like those diary apps where you can like write something down every day. And so I had a lot of those and I never actually used them.
Right. And did you find yourself like missing things once you had to delete them?
Yeah. One of the ones that I had a hard time letting go of was TikTok. I used it probably the most throughout the day, and I didn't realize just how much until I had to delete it. What I would tend to do is I would go on it after work, think that I would spend like maybe 20 minutes on it, and I'd end up being on there for like an hour when I should be making dinner, preparing for the next day, doing my chores around the house. Yeah.
So you're in kind of an interesting position because we've all been talking about things that we would like to do less of, but you've sort of forced yourself into a situation where you're already doing less of it. So is there anything that you would like to go on to change or anything in particular you've learned about this experience of having to do that?
Well, one thing is I will get a new phone.
What?
I mean, I think 64 gigs is not enough on a smartphone. Right now, all I can really do on my phone is call people and text people. And I feel like at this point, that's even less than the bare minimum.
Right.
And so as tough it is to admit, I think I will do that. But I think I'll be more mindful of, I guess, the sorts of apps I'm downloading. Mm-hmm. What's the reason? How does it benefit me? Mm-hmm. Yes, TikTok will be one of the apps I re-download.
Okay.
But now that I know how I use it, I'll maybe be more mindful. I hope.
Okay.
I don't know if I really learned anything at this point, but my goal is to use my phone less and take less photos on my phone. Mm-hmm. Before I got like my iPhone, like I would use my film camera a lot more. And so maybe now I should actually go back to doing that. I feel like there was a lot of joy that came out of doing those things that the iPhone kind of replaced.
Yeah. And how about Spark producer McKenna Hadley-Burke?
Every day I wake up and instead of engaging with anything remotely educational or something that's going to give me like a step forward in my day, I end up just spiraling back onto TikTok. That's the place that I keep getting stuck in. And then throughout the day, if I have that lull where I'm just like, you know, I just need some reprieve, like 5 minutes of brainless, numbing kind of engagement, I'm going to go on TikTok. And then it's this spiral of just one video after another. And none of it's ever anything that sticks with me, but I'll go back on it in an hour.
So if none of it's something that sticks with you, can't you have a sense of what it is about it that keeps pulling you back in?
I find if I'm emotionally overwhelmed or I'm stressed out, I'll go on TikTok instead of lingering in that feeling because it's just a way to disassociate. It's someone else's stories, someone else's content, and I can just lose myself in this kind of whirlwind of just noise that has nothing to do with my day or what I need to be stressed about or what I need to think about.
Yeah. But would you say you enjoy it?
You know, that's such a difficult thing because I keep sitting here being like, just delete the app. It's not serving you. And yet I keep returning to it.
So what would you like to commit to trying to do over the summer?
I mean, what I want to say is I'm going to delete the app. I'm not going to go on it at all anymore and hope that enough space from it stops that urge to open the app throughout the day. That's what I want to say. Realistically, I'm probably going to try to get down to like visiting the app once a day and setting aside time to only do it once a day. So maybe there's a two-sided goal there, one that I think is realistic and one that I wish I was probably going to do.
So those are the digital habits the Spark team would like to break this summer. Now, here's my challenge to you. Is there a part of your digital life that you'd like to bring into balance? How about committing to trying that over the summer, whatever that looks like for you? Taking that overused app off your phone, storing your phone somewhere it's harder to get at when you're out and about, your call. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Michelle Parisi, Samarit Yohannes, McKenna Hadley-Burke, and me, Nora Young. And by Gaia Bernstein and Anna Lemke. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on social media, SparkCBC. Starting next week, as you endeavor to enjoy the summertime, our 10-part series, The Butterfly Effect, will also be on for you to enjoy. That's all summer long. I hope you tune in. I'm Nora Young. It's been great talking tech with you this season. Thanks for joining me. That seemed good.
It didn't get all the funny stuff from before.
Okay.
Yeah, I
I don't know if I really learned anything at this point.
Oh, there's a plane going overhead, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to edit it out.
Michelle's shrugging.
Okay.
Or I'm not going to look at TikTok first thing in the morning or whatever it is. It's called self-binding.
She said TikTok.
Did I call it TikTok?
Not in the recording. Not in the recording.
McKenna, we are tired and our brains don't make sense.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.